Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
Welcome to the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Rivenis. In recent weeks, I watched the television version of The Man in the High Castle, the dystopian alternate history based on the novel by Philip K. Dick. In it, he imagines that Germany and Japan had won World War II and had carved up the United States for their spoils. It's hard to imagine Americans greeting each other with Heil Hitlers, but it actually did happen in the years leading up to Pearl Harbor. Many German Americans heard a call from the fatherland, and that is our subject on this week's episode. I'm joined by Arnie Bernstein, author of a gem of a book called Swastika Nation, Fritz Kuhn and the Rise and Fall of the German-American Bund. He also wrote an award-winning 2009 book called The Bath Massacre, America's First School Bombing. I appreciate your time today, Mr. Bernstein.
Thank you very much.
So, for those of us who don't speak German, what is a Bund?
A Bund is it's a common name. It means brotherhood, and also it like a fraternal organization in that sense of the term. And, I mean, you find Bunds in, you know, all sorts of places. They're still quite active today, different kinds of Bunds, certainly not the German-American Bund. But it's a very common word.
Now, the German-American Bund is known in the 1930s as the unofficial spokesorganization for Nazism in America. What were the beginnings of this group, and how did it develop?
Okay. The German-American Bund is actually an outgrowth of a couple of different organizations. During World War I, as we know, Germans were, in America, were persona non grata, even though German, you know, Americans had been in this country for decades, for generations. But being German became persona non grata. The Beethoven was taken out of standard, you know, orchestral, you know, repertoires. German language is no longer allowed to be taught in schools. Food. Sauerkraut became, of course, the famous Liberty cabbage.
Right.
The Wiener Schnitzels became hot dogs, and that one kind of stuck. But Germans were also treated terribly. German Americans, as I say, some immigrants who were loyal Americans and others who had, their families had been in this country for generations, they were terribly mistreated. In some cases, they were forced to sit in the public square and kiss the American flag. There were other cases where they were spied on for no good reason whatsoever. There was a group called the American Protection League, which sort of operated with a wink and a nod from the Justice Department. It was, you know, designed to look out for spies, whether, you know, albeit whether they were spies or not. In the post-war era, German Americans realized they were alone, and they started banding together in different groups. Now, one was the Van Steuben Society, which is still around and was designed to rehabilitate the image of Germany and Germans in America. It was popular and a large group that it was received quite well by the majority of Americans. However, there were other groups who felt that they just couldn't get a fair shake in America, and they started looking to what was going on in Germany for guidance. This is around the late teens, early 20s, when Hitler was starting his rise to power. The first of these groups was known as Friends of Teutonia. As I say, they were inspired by what was going on. They had uniforms, they had lodges. They were largely concentrated in cities, Chicago, New York, Milwaukee, cities with large German populations. This group kind of morphed into a group called the Friends of New Germany, which came around in the late 1920s. The Friends of New Germany was better organized. The big problem you see with a lot of these groups leading up to the German-American Bund was they were terribly organized. But the Friends of New Germany, they were able to establish a series of family retreats. They had different groups, lodges, if you will. They split the country into three GAUs, G-A-U. The East Coast, which was headquartered in New York, the Midwest, headquartered in Chicago, and the West, which was headquartered in L.A. They had their own uniforms, which were similar to the brown shirts. They wore swastikas. They had, you know, the family retreats, things like that. They organized meetings. They handed out literature. But they were also something of an embarrassment. And at this time, keep in mind, we didn't know who Hitler was. The United States government was still trying to figure him out.
Right.
And so the Germans really didn't want anything to do with them. And word came down from the high German command in 1935. It said, you have to dissolve. And the head of the Friends of New Germany couldn't believe this. And he went to Germany and they said, yes, you are to dissolve. So they were dissolved on Christmas Day of 1935. But there still were plenty of them around. Now I want to backtrack a little bit. As I say, people were concerned about this group, and a committee was formed in Congress, which eventually became what we know as the House Un-American Activities Committee, was formed to investigate them, as well as the Ku Klux Klan and people who were loyal to Mussolini. There were hearings held in D.C. at various cities. At one hearing in New York, a riot broke out. It was really something. They had chapters throughout the country, and in Detroit, there was a German immigrant by the name of Fritz Kuhn who joined the group in Detroit, and he rapidly rose through the ranks, and he insisted that the only way the Friends of New Germany could succeed is if they turned their gaze, instead of to Germany, to America, and made themselves a German-American organization. Certainly loyal to Hitler, but they had to keep their eyes on America and be involved in America, and thus, you know, exporting the Hitler philosophy to the United States in a way that Friends of New Germany could not, because they were clearly, by their name alone, aligned with Germany, whereas German-American emphasized the American aspect of it. And they were formed in 1936 at a convention in Buffalo, New York.
Let's talk about Fritz Kuhn, the main figure in your book. He comes from modest beginnings and eventually works for the notoriously anti-Semitic Henry Ford.
Oh, yeah. Now, Fritz Kuhn's an interesting character. He was born in Germany, served in World War I. Actually, a lot of his life parallels Hitler, which is interesting. Both he and Hitler received, you know, distinguished honors in World War I. Fritz Kuhn claimed that he followed Hitler into the beer hall putsch. Fritz Kuhn claimed a lot of things. There's no way of knowing whether or not this was true. He later denied it. But after the war, he went to school. He got what was the equivalent of a master's degree in chemistry at the University of Munich. He was caught rifling through the coats of his fellow students and stealing. He went to prison for 6 months. Upon his release, his father got him a job at a factory, a clothing factory, owned by a Jewish man, interestingly enough. The factory owner noticed that he was coming up short on the bolts of cloth that he ordered. He thought it was the supplier, and turned out it wasn't the supplier. So he started investigating, and lo and behold, he caught Fritz Kuhn cutting off bolts of cloth, smuggling them out to a Confederate, and selling them on the black market. Well, he wanted to press charges, but Kuhn's father convinced him that, you know, his boy needed a fresh start. He had just married, children were on the way. So the man took pity on him, and they arranged for Kuhn to go to Mexico, which was kind of a standard because so many young Germans were getting out of Germany. The economy is so horrible. They wanted to have a fresh start in a place where they could make a decent living. So many went to Mexico, and from there they would go to the United States. Now, Kuhn got started in Mexico. He worked as a chemist for a while, which was his training. He worked as a teacher. And a friend of his says, you need to go to Detroit. The automobile industry is, you know, thriving there. A lot of Germans are working there, a lot of German immigrants. And so Kuhn went to Detroit and got a job with the Henry Ford Hospital, working as an X-ray technician. Now, this must have been a dream place for Kuhn, who was Hitler loyal. And the Henry Ford Hospital was run by Ernest Liebold, who was Ford's right-hand man. And I love that his name is spelled L-I-E-B-O-L-D, Liebold. It's beautiful. But the hospital had a policy of no Jewish doctors whatsoever. And so Kuhn must have loved this. He became an X-ray technician there. Eventually his wife and children came up. And Kuhn got involved in the Friends of New Germany. And as I said before, he quickly rose through the ranks and became leader of the Detroit branch and then the Midwest branch.
There's so much in this book, so many interesting stories. So I'm going to handpick some of my personal favorites, if you don't mind.
It's hard to cram all this into an hour. It's you know, my big problem with the book is, where do I stop? I was literally writing the book up until the final hour I had to send it in, because there's just so much information.
And you really must have had to summarize some of these stories. I'm guessing you could have easily expanded on a lot of these incidents.
Oh, I easily could have gone 120,000 words.
Right.
And my editor told me, there's no way it's going to be 120,000 words. It kills me how much I had to leave out. But anyway.
So back to what I was going to say. In a chapter of your book, you talk about a trip back to the fatherland during the 36 Olympics for members of the Bund. Can you talk about their visit to Germany and Fritz Kuhn's meeting with Adolf Hitler?
Sure. Now, after Kuhn became leader of the Bund, as I say, the Friends of New Germany dissolved, and under his leadership and vision, it became the German-American Bund in April of 1936. He was known as the Bundesführer. Now, in the Friends of New Germany, the title was president because they felt only one man could be called the Führer, and that was Adolf Hitler. But Kuhn's ego was massive, and he wanted to be a Führer as well, so he became the Führer of the Bund, the Bundesführer. And he felt now that they were the German-American Bund, they needed recognition from Nazi Germany. They wanted, you know, the blessing, in essence. So he and a delegation went to Germany during the 1936 Olympics. They went to various sites, graves of the Nazi martyrs, as it were, and they were marched in a parade that was held under which Hitler was reviewing. They somehow were able to pull some strings and got into this parade. And a former member of the Friends of New Germany, who had repatriated back to Germany and was friends with Fritz Kuhn, was able to pull some strings and said, yes, we can get you a meeting with Hitler. Now, here's a sentence you won't hear too often. To Hitler's credit, and we'll go from there, he had no idea who this Fritz Kuhn was or what the German-American Bund was. In essence, this meeting was a standard grip-and-grin thing that you see with politicians from, you know, the local mayor to heads of state. You know, who's this guy? This is who it is. Okay, you know, take a picture, smile. And that's what this was. It was, of course, the International Olympics. It was Hitler's showcase, and he did all kinds of meetings with all kinds of groups. So in came Kuhn and his delegation, you know, wearing their swastikas and, you know, explaining who they were and what they were doing back in America. And there's a famous photo of Hitler shaking hands with Fritz Kuhn. Hitler listens, and he says, go back to America and continue your work. Well, Kuhn thought this was the blessing that he wanted. This was Hitler saying, you are my boys in America. Of course, it was just an offhand remark by Hitler, but even so. They return to America, and Kuhn is just drunk with power now. And he decides, you know, as an American organization, they need to get involved in the American election. And they have to endorse a presidential candidate. They can't endorse Roosevelt, obviously, because, of course, he was a hidden Jew, as we all know. His real name was Rosenfeld, as you know, as you know, many Germans believed, many Nazis believed. He was Rosenfeld, not Roosevelt. There was a third-party candidate who was a senator from, I believe it was South Dakota or North Dakota, and he had a German background, but Kuhn dismissed him as being German in name only. So they settled on Alf Landon, the Republican candidate, who they felt would be best for Nazi Germany. What Kuhn did not realize, of course, was that a couple of years earlier, a coalition of 50 American rabbis had given Landon an award for his work with the American Jewish Committee. Now, after they made this endorsement, of course, Landon didn't even, you know, acknowledge it, but Germany got worried because the American embassy came to the Germans and said, "What is this? Are you endorsing candidates in the American election?" Nazi Germany said, "They don't want to get involved." As I say, we didn't know who Hitler was. Joe Kennedy, the American ambassador to England, and Chamberlain, the prime minister, thought there was possibilities we could work with Hitler. So the embassy went to Kuhn and said, cut it out. You're not endorsing, you don't stand for us. So they had to set their sights elsewhere. And that was on developing the Bund and developing a strong German-American Bund and their agenda in America.
And part of that agenda is to start establishing camps.
Yeah. Now, as I say in the book, if Kuhn had been a businessman, he would have been a genius. He would have been a genius in the middle of the Depression because he took a wheezing, dying organization that was the Friends of New Germany, you know, that had a constitution, that had, you know, various beginnings of businesses, things like that. But he took this, you know, nascent constitution, and he built it up. And he built up a series of businesses, printing, they had their own newspaper, a national newspaper, a series of, you know, manufacturing trinkets, uniforms, things like that. And they were a money-making organization. He really had a gift for this kind of thing. And they also took over the Friends of New Germany's camps and built them into a really strong kind of family retreat / summer camp. Families would come there on the weekends. There were camps throughout the country. Most of them were east. There was Camp Norland in New Jersey. There was Camp Siegfried in Long Island, which is probably the most notorious of the camps. There was Camp Van Steuben, which was just outside of Milwaukee, and many others throughout the country. As I say, there were family organizations, family events held on these things, things you'd find in any kind of German festival, you know, beer, Oktoberfest sort of things, you know, songs, dances, but with swastika flags flying side by side with the American flag and people giving, you know, pro-Nazi speeches, things like that. There were children's events as well. They had their own equivalent of Hitler Youth, you know, for boys and girls as well as for teenagers. And kids came to these, and there were, you know, things like swimming, you know, athletic events, you know, arts and crafts, all kinds of things you would expect to find at a summer camp. But it was with a Nazi flair. The kids would be rousted from bed in the middle of the night. They would be forced to go on these long marches. They'd have to go through bramble and brush, and they couldn't complain. That was a sign of weakness, and, you know, no matter how cut up or, you know, bruised they got, too bad. You know, you're not weak. You are a strong German. They would meet in the middle of the night in, after going through these marches in, like, fields, and there would be bonfires, and they would sing Deutschland über alles, the German national anthem. They would sing the Horst Wessel Lied, which was the Nazi theme song. They would Heil Hitler and denounce Roosevelt. There would be no American flags. They were grooming future Nazis.
Okay, so I found this fascinating. You mentioned in your writing that Hitler and many of the Nazis had a special place in their hearts for Native Americans, which is, of course, completely contradictory to what we think of as Hitler's pursuit of a dominant Aryan race. Can you talk about the Bund's courtship of Native Americans in the U.S. in the 30s?
Sure. Among the many wild turns that I found in doing the research on this was an outreach to Native Americans. Now, Hitler had a fascination with a German writer by the name of Karl May. May had never left Germany, but he wrote these westerns about a brave cowboy and his loyal Native American, you know, or Indian, as it were, you know, use the vernacular of the time, you know, sidekick. though certainly Indians were not Aryans. He found their stoic presence and their loyalty to their race to be an ideal for Germans. He loved the Karl May novels, and consequently they were very popular in Germany. Well, Kuhn had an outreach to Native American populations. Keep in mind that this time there was something called the Indian Bureau, which was working with, you know, the various, you know, reservations and tribal leaders. There were a couple of people of Native American ancestry who did not like Roosevelt because it was intruding on their businesses. One was called Chief Red Cloud, and the other was Chief New Moon. And they would make speeches to various Native American groups. They would wear swastikas, which actually is an ancient symbol if you look at the history of the swastika. It was, you know, from India. You still see, you know, Hindu art with swastikas. If you look at Native American art, there was the swastika was involved in that. You know, there was a town named Swastika, Canada. The swastika is an ancient symbol, and then, you know, once it was, you know, taken over by the Nazis, it became an infamous symbol beyond rehabilitation. They made these speeches, but actually their Native American outreach was a front. And they were using it to launder money and to squeeze money out of Native American charities. They had, this is kind of funny, that of course it was notoriously anti-Semitic, these speeches. And they said there was an ancient Indian word called Chukajan, which, you know, meant the, you know, the devil's people, the evil Jews. And the anti-Semitism was an important part of Native American history. Yeah, of course, it was all fabrication. And these two guys were, you know, the business guys who simply threw on the Native American garb. And for the most part, it's an ancillary but highly entertaining story to the German-American Bund.
Part of your story that I find so comforting, inspiring, is that the First Amendment, in the form of famed American columnist Walter Winchell, helps defeat the fascists that are trying to conquer America from within. Can you talk about Walter Winchell? Who was he, and how did he make himself an adversary of Kuhn?
I think Walter Winchell is the really unsung hero of this story, and I'm so happy to sing his praises. He was born the grandson of a rabbi, danced in vaudeville with, I believe it was George Jessel, and eventually became a newspaper man. He wrote for various newspapers in New York and quickly established himself as an entertainment Broadway columnist. Eventually got his own column with the New York Mirror. And he was probably the most feared man in America at some point because he could make or break a Broadway show or Hollywood. People were always feeding him tips. Politicians started feeding him tips. He wasn't bound by, you know, the fetters of journalism. I mean, he didn't have to pay attention to things like, you know, ethics or honesty or stuff like that. But he was one of the first people to recognize what was going on in Germany. And he was one of the first people to start talking about Hitler in print. And he savaged Hitler in a way that, as I say, the standard press could not. You know, it's not, you know, politically correct in our times, but he started making what we, I guess we could call gay jokes about Hitler. He said, from now we're going to call him Adele Hitler. And, you know, he just savaged him. And Winchell said to a friend of his, he said, I know this is, you know, making the homosexual jokes is going a little far, but when you talk about someone like Hitler, you know, you have to use anything that's out there. And Winchell was, of course, hated by Hitler and considered an enemy by Nazi Germany. Winchell wore it as a badge of honor and really enjoyed it. Well, he was also one of the first people to realize what Fritz Kuhn was all about. And so he started attacking Fritz Kuhn in his column. There's a wonderful series of things that he called Fritz Kuhn, and I want to get this out here. Yeah, okay. Fritz Kuhn, Kuhn Nazi, the Shame American, Fat Fritz Kuhn, the Local Anesthetic. I don't understand that one. He called him Communist Fritz Kuhn, which is, again, another weird choice because Kuhn was strongly anti-communist. Life's Little Ironist, I don't understand that one either. Fritz Confucius, Son of a Fritz, the Beef Bundant, I like that one a lot, and Chief of the Ratsies. Of course, he didn't call them Nazis, he called them Ratsies. And he just had a good time with Kuhn. Kuhn, of course, hated Winchell. And he swore that he would hang Winchell from the highest light pole in front of the Stork Club, which was, you know, Winchell's New York hangout, you know, bon vivant club. And, of course, Winchell continued to go coon in the column. He just absolutely loved it.
Back after a word from our sponsors.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day, 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
And we have returned to the interview. So you tell the story of the golem, a mythical creature manifested by rabbis to fight anti-Semitism in Prague in the 1600s. And we end up with a 1930s manifestation of the golem in the form of an assortment of Jewish gangsters. Can you explain who they were and how they got pulled into the fight against the German-American Bund?
Sure. Now, one of my big problems with gangster books is that these guys tend to get portrayed as Robin Hoods. These were not Robin Hoods. They were thugs. They were killers. They destroyed lives. But they had this moment. You know, these people like Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, Longies Willman in New Jersey, Mickey Cohn out in L.A., where even though they were, you know, they had fallen away from the faith, there was something about them that was still inherently Jewish. Now, keep in mind, and this is going to sound a little crazy, the mob was anti-Semitic. And Mickey Cohn himself in his, you know, autobiography said, you know, the problem with it was the guys like him and Lansky and Siegel could never be, you know, part and parcel with the Italians. They could never get up to the ranks that they wanted to. And even if they did, you know, I mean, Meyer Lansky, you know, more or less invented what became the modern mafia. He still had to face anti-Semitism within the organization, which I find fascinating. In fact, Lucky Luciano, who was Lansky's boyhood friend, had to intercede to the other top Italians and say, you know what, we need to work with these Jews. I know you don't like them, but we need to work with them. They're smart, they're good with money, they're good with numbers. You know, all the standard, you know, canards
right.
They used so that they could work with the Jews. It's crazy stuff. And, of course, they were looked down in by the Jewish community. You know, they were thugs. They were gangsters. We want nothing to do with these people. You know, gambling, you know, loan sharking, all that stuff. We want nothing to do with the Meyer Lanskys of this world. But the German-American Bund was a frightening force. to the American Jewish community. So, according to Meyer Lansky, now this is according to Meyer Lansky in the book he did with Yuri Dan, the Israeli journalist, the series of interviews they did, that he was approached by Rabbi Stephen Weiss and Nathan Perlman, who was an important judge and later congressman in New York. They approached Lansky in a secret meeting. And they said, Meyer, we know you have means and methods that we don't. And we know you can do something about these Bundes that we can't. And we're willing to pay you. And Lansky said, oh, no, you don't have to pay us. We'll be happy to do this. At their core, they were nice Jewish boys who wanted to do something for their people. And like I say, like you said, you know, the golem, the kind of scary, you know, creature who defended the Jews from the oppressors and the anti-Semites, it was big and scary, but it was our big and scary. So Lansky and Perlman struck a deal. Among other things, no killing, which Lansky was disappointed about, but okay. And Lansky asked in return that they not be smeared in the Jewish press because of this. And Perlman said, I'll see what I can do. And so Lansky and the boys went to work, and they started breaking up meetings and breaking up bones. Longy Zwillman, who was sort of a Jewish Tony Soprano, he ran Jersey, and he ran Northern Jersey. He established an army of former prize fighters, people like Nick Arno and other Jewish prize fighters. They were called the Minutemen because they could be there in a minute, and they broke up a lot of meetings. Zwillman's chauffeur, who later became a notorious hitman, was later asked, did you tell them that you were Jewish? And he said, the only thing we told them was with a baseball bat. And they were quite effective. Winchell, who lived in the same building as Meyer Lansky, the same New York, you know, apartment building, approached Lansky with a tip. He said, the Bundes are going to be meeting at this hall in Yorkville, the big German community in New York. And so Lansky sent his boys out there. And they broke up the meeting with fists and bats and things like that. And after the incident, Lansky went back to Winchell. He said, oh, you got everything right, but the address, you had the wrong address. And, of course, Lansky had means and methods that even Winchell didn't have to information. Out west, Mickey Cohn also got involved. He was approached by people within the film industry. Screenwriters, things like that, because there were Bundists who were working within the film industry and were giving a hard time, you know, and causing problems. And so, and both Mickey Cohn and Meyer Lansky said that, you know, they really enjoyed doing it. But then, even though Nathan Perlman had said he would see what he could do, the Jewish press started reporting on, you know, these events and shaming them, in essence, saying, we don't do this, we're Jews, we don't get involved in such, you know, sordid, terrible things as, you know, gangsterism and things like that. And so Perlman said, you know what, I have to call you back. And Lansky was disappointed, but he said, you know, if a learned man like Nathan Perlman said we can't do it, then okay, we can't do it. But what was his big disappointment was that was when the New York papers started referring to him as a gangster. He had never been referred to as a gangster before in the New York press. And he said to his friends and the journalists who were, you know, essentially on the payroll, you know, of the mob, he said, why are you calling me a gangster? They said, well, you know, the Jewish press is starting to do it, so it's out there. We can do it too. And Lansky said, I had no answer to that one. But I look at them too, in the, you know, as I say, they were bad guys. I don't condone, you know, gangsters, but they had this brief moment where they did the right thing. And I look at it as the Jewish, you know, holiday of Yom Kippur, where we atone for our sins, the Day of Atonement, it's known as, and where one goes into the synagogue and atones for their sins. I look at this as a kind of an atonement. They knew they were bad. They knew they were doing terrible things. But for this brief moment, they stood up for their people and, in a way, tried to make up for the terrible things they were doing by fighting back and protecting their people from a Nazi menace.
So you've got the series of stories, one after another, of these Jewish mobsters inflicting damage on American Nazis. And you couldn't make this up if you tried. And it would make an incredible TV series, by the way. But since we don't have time for you to talk about each and every one of these stories, could you pick out one of your favorites and tell it to us?
Okay, in Chicago, there was a guy by the name of Jacob Rubenstein. He had started off as a, you know, a low-level guy. When he was a kid, he and his friend Barney Ross, who later became the, you know, the heavyweight champion and held championship and two other weight titles as well. They would deliver envelopes for Capone for like a buck an envelope, no questions asked. He was always operating on the fringes of the outfit, the mob, as it's known here in Chicago. And Jacob Rupert Singh would hang out on the west side of Chicago in a place called Davy Miller's Pool Hall, which was a front for a lot of the Jewish mobsters. And they would get phone calls saying, hey, the Bundy is having a meeting here, the Bundy is having a meeting there. And he would go out with his crew, and they would beat the living stuffings out of these guys. They, you know, with their bats, with their fists. And Rubenstein's brother would recall that Jakey would come home and he'd be covered in blood and just grinning. He just enjoyed doing this kind of work. You know, after the war is over, Jacob Rubenstein moves down to Dallas, changes his name to Jack Ruby, and the rest is history, as we all know. This is all in the Warren Report, by the way. And that's where I got the information from. And I'd like to point out, it's the only true stuff in the Warren Report.
Right.
That's neither here nor there, right? It's that's another podcast. Anyway.
So that is a good story. So back to Fritz Kuhn. At his height, as the leader of the German-American Bund, he lives in Queens, New York, with his family. But he's far from a family man, right?
Oh, God, yeah. Now, Fritz Kuhn was heavyset, wore thick, you know, like Coke bottle glasses, heavy jowls, balding, not exactly, you know, the best-looking guy in town, but he was, to use today's terms, a chick magnet. He had countless affairs when he was working at Henry Ford, just a notorious womanizer. The higher up he went in the organization, he would have affairs with secretaries, things like that. And he was often seen around town escorting, you know, comely blonde women. Mrs. Kuhn, of course, was in total denial about this. Whenever the accusations would come up, well, you know, he and I are working on a marriage, or, oh, no, this is not true, things like that. But it was well known throughout the Bund that Kuhn was womanizing. Not that it was approved, but it was well known. Now, there was a moment when Walter Winchell, when he was holding court at the Stork Club, he looks up, and there is Fritz Kuhn, his mortal enemy, squiring a blonde. The two of them locked eyes, and Kuhn blinked and left the Stork Club. Winchell was furious, and in fact, he went to the bathroom. He carried a gun for protection, because after he had first started writing these columns about Hitler and the Bund, he was attacked by a couple of brown shirts who broke a crown, actually, in his mouth. And brown shirts disappeared in the crowd. They attacked him as he was coming out of his barbershop. And so after that, he started carrying a gun for protection. Well, after he saw Kuhn in the Stork Club, he went into the bathroom, and he pulled all the bullets out of the gun because he couldn't trust himself. He was that angry. But, you know, as I say, Kuhn was a notorious womanizer. This, of course, led to his downfall.
So before we get to his downfall, the cover of your book is a photograph of a rally at Madison Square Garden. And this rally becomes Fritz Kuhn's crowning achievement.
This is Kuhn's high point. It's February 21st of 1939. He's been at this for not quite 3 years. He's built up an empire, family retreats, all kinds of stuff. And he's at the height of his power in 1939. You know, he's built up this organization, businesses, newspapers, family retreats. He's known from coast to coast. He's giving speeches. People fear him. And he was a scary figure. A lot of people were really afraid of him. They were a small organization, but they were a loud organization. You know, they were, at its height, there were maybe, they never released figures. They were notoriously bad record keepers, too. Kuhn liked to say there were 200,000 people. That's, of course, one of his many exaggerations. The FBI estimated maybe 5,000 to 10,000. But on February 21st, 1939, he wanted to hold a rally, the George Washington's birthday rally. They wanted to, keep in mind, as I said, they wanted to sell themselves as an American organization. So they were honoring George Washington, the first American fascist. And as we all know, George Washington was a dangerous fascist. They rented Madison Square Garden. They had to. Madison Square Garden had to do it. You have the right to be obnoxious in this country. Freedom of speech is an absolute, and he had that right. So they didn't have much of a choice. They had to rent it to them. They said in the stipulation, no anti-Semitic signs, no swastikas being displayed, things like that. And Kuhn agreed, and of course he ignored that completely once they had the rally set. There were 20,000 people packed into Madison Square Garden for this rally. You can see footage of it on YouTube. It looks like a mini, you know, triumph of the will for Fritz Kuhn, which is probably how he saw it, with drum lines and with flags and with a lot of pomp and circumstance. He gets up there, he's making his speech. One guy who snuck in, he was a plumber out of Brooklyn, Jewish plumber out of Brooklyn, rushed the stage to knock down Fritz Kuhn, and the OD, which was Fritz Kuhn's guard unit, they were sort of an equivalent to the SS, jumped the guy and started beating him up on stage, and of course the crowd cheered. They loved this moment. It was, you know, an unplanned and wonderful moment for them. And this guy had to be arrested by the New York police because he was disrupting this. They had their right to be obnoxious. But while there were 20,000 German-American Bundes celebrating, you know, George Washington, ha, 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 inside the Madison Square Garden, outside were 100,000 people, they estimated, all wanting to kill him. There were people swarming around Madison Square Garden, and it was just about everybody. There were business people, there were housewives, there were Jewish groups, there were Catholic groups, there were communist and Trotskyite groups, just about everybody you could possibly imagine outside of Madison Square Garden. And the police chief said, we have enough men out here to stop a riot. At one point, there was a mysterious voice that was shouting from a room above the street saying, go away, you are not wanted here in this country, go away, you know, German-American Bund. And the police had to storm it. They had no idea who was in this room, you know, and they didn't know if somebody with a gun or whatever. They went in there, and it was a record player inside a bare room. Somebody had rented the room and set up this record player with a speaker. it's incredible what was going on out there. Well, Fiorello LaGuardia, the mayor of New York, was furious. Not in his city. This was a bad black mark on his city. And a few weeks later, they held a rally at Carnegie Hall, which was a rally for freedom. It was sort of the anti-Bundist rally. And they actually had people who had escaped from Nazi Germany speak at this rally, as well as prominent German-Americans, you know, speaking out against the German-American Bund. Now, LaGuardia wanted to bring down Kuhn in the worst way, but he couldn't get him on freedom of speech. He had the right to be obnoxious in this country. And LaGuardia, when he was confronted about Kuhn on several occasions, said he has that right. But this Madison Square Garden rally was too much. So he called in Thomas Dewey, who at that time was prosecutor, the leading prosecutor for the city of New York. And this was before he ran for governor, before he became president. And he said, we got to get him on something. So they started looking, and they found that there were all these little, you know, programs and souvenirs and things like that that were sold at the rally, and they hadn't paid taxes on them. And so LaGuardia said, let's get him on these tax thing. You know, just like we got Capone. They got Capone on taxes. They couldn't get him on anything else. So they got him on his taxes. And Dewey said, no, we can get him on something bigger. Let's start looking. Now, throughout this, throughout the history of the Bund, the Congress, HUAC, as I talked about before, House Un-American Activities Committee, had been investigating as well. And in the wake of the rally, they wanted to investigate as well. So the FBI had kept tabs on Kuhn, had kept tabs on the Bund, and had considerable files on them as well. And one thing they focused on, of course, was Kuhn's womanizing. They approached one of his mistresses, and this woman may or may not have been Miss America. You'll have to read the book to find out. And they said, listen, we want to go after Kuhn. We can use you to get Kuhn. And she agreed. So they set up a recording system in the room where, which Kuhn was paying for to keep her in, you know, as his secret mistress. They set up a recording system in there. And the guy who was in charge of the recording, you know, they listen. And the FBI files describe, by the way, describe these recordings as quite spicy. There was some pretty intense, you know, hot and heavy liaisons going inside this room. At one point, Kuhn, you know, asked her if he could carve a swastika between her breasts.
He
cut himself with a razor blade to show her how simple it was. And the guy who was listening in almost ran in to, you know, he's going to blow the cover because he didn't want, you know, some sort of bloody foray. And she was able to talk him out of it. And the cover was not blown. It turned out this woman, Virginia Cogswell, was going to a psychiatrist. The Cogswell herself has a really interesting history. She was sort of a mini celebrity in that she was famous for having been married 9 times. And she was known throughout the country for this. And she had written a newspaper article about it. It was kind of, you know, I'll never have a cast of characters like this again, from nice. Fritz Kuhn to, you know, the gangsters, to Walter Winchell, to Edward G. Robinson shows up, and, you know, and Virginia Cogswell. And it's such a crazy cast of characters. But it turned out she was going to a psychiatrist for her nerves. And so as part of the deal for her going undercover, the government would pay her psychiatric bills. There was a guy named Richard Rollins. Richard Rollins was the secret investigator for the government who was listening in on Kuhn. Rollins went to visit her psychiatrist, and, you know, they were paying the bills, made sense. And he said, so who was paying the bills before us? And it turned out Fritz Kuhn had been paying the bills. And the psychiatrist showed Rollins a check. And it was a check on the German-American Bunz account that was made out to the psychiatrist. Well, there they had the smoking gun in their hands. Forget the little, you know, penny ante, you know, tax evasion stuff. He was embezzling from the German-American Bund to fund his affairs. And that's how they got Fritz Kuhn. That's how they put Fritz Kuhn to a stop, and that's how they ended the German-American Bund, effectively. They took Kuhn to trial on embezzlement charges, and it was an incredible trial where some of his love letters were read out loud, and they were written like a 12-year-old would write, you know, in junior high school. They were that bad and that mushy. And Kuhn ended up being found guilty of embezzling the Bund and was sent to Sing Sing as a result. And that ultimately led to his downfall, was his womanizing. Not, you know, his Nazism, but his womanizing. And the Bund sort of tried to maintain itself, but they lost, in essence, a very strong leader. This was in 1939. He went to jail November of 1939. He went to Sing Sing. And the Bund kind of flapped around for a little bit, you know, trying to, you know, maintain, you know, some semblance of order. But clearly it was heating up. You know, war rhetoric was heating up in the United States. And then, you know, Hitler was being seen for the monster that he was. And then there was Pearl Harbor. And the Bund officially dissolved a few days later after Pearl Harbor, although they had been dying for, you know, ever since, you know, Kuhn had been sent to jail. That was, in essence, the death knell.
And then Fritz Kuhn is deported back to Germany, and he lives and dies in obscurity.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah, he lived in obscurity, went through denazification. He was held in prison and actually escaped from prison and was eventually found. He also, in variation on a theme, was involved with a young woman who was a waitress at a American Army base and was fired once it was discovered she was involved with Fritz Kuhn. And, of course, Mrs. Kuhn completely denies, why would he be involved? He's married to me. And Fritz Kuhn died in obscurity, heart disease, emphysema. He was a lifelong chain smoker. In America, they didn't even know he had died until 2 years later. And Walter Winchell wrote in his column, shrug. That was his obit for Fritz Kuhn. Shrug.
And that's a great way to end this episode. Thank you for your time, Mr. Bernstein.
Oh, thank you. I so appreciate it. Like I say, I love the podcast.
Oh, I appreciate that so much. Thanks. And for people who want to connect with you, they can visit your website at www.arniebernstein.com with links to Amazon and options for getting personally signed books.
If people want to connect to me on Facebook, that's cool too.
Thanks for spending some time with me, Eric Rivenis, as I broadcast true life tales of crime, criminals, and terrible tragedies to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. And if you've got some spare reading time and you're finished with Arnie's book or any other of my guests' books and you're looking for some straight-up historical fiction, go right now to Amazon and type in The Big Mitt. This has nothing to do with baseball, but instead a card game played by bunco artists in cahoots with the cops in turn-of-the-century Minneapolis. It's a great read for anyone looking for some action and some accurate history. And I am telling you, my streetcar chase scene is one for the ages. Good day to you, and let's talk again next week.